heat is in proportion to the want of true knowledge. This is the heat.
It was the hottest March on record as global temperatures over the past 12 months soared past pre-industrial levels. Hello, I'm Arnold Naidoo and this is The Heat. Leaders from 40 countries wrapped up talks Friday aimed at increasing momentum for the forthcoming International Climate Change Summit later this year. The discussions in Berlin were intended to keep targets for mitigating global warming on track at the UN-led conference in Azerbaijan later this year. But after the hottest March on record, forecasters are expecting another sweltering summer in the Northern Hemisphere. And as Owen Fairclough reports, the impact of record-breaking heat is already impacting some of the most vulnerable parts of our planet.
Majestic, but in danger of extinction, Antarctica's emperor penguins can't survive without ice, and it's disappearing.
The emperor penguins breed on the sea ice, the frozen sea that surrounds Antarctica. They have their eggs on there in the Antarctic winter, and they raise their chicks. By the end of the season, they need to get their waterproof feathers before the sea ice, the ice on which they're standing on, breaks up. If that ice breaks up too early, then they'll go into the water without their waterproof feathers and they'll die. They'll either freeze to death or they'll drown.
The British Antarctic Survey estimates tens of thousands of emperor penguin chicks perished last year due to record high global temperatures that left summer ice levels at record lows. And those records continue to tumble. March, the hottest on record, as was the winter before it.
Our models are quite dire. We're predicting that we'll lose around 99%, possibly at least, of all the emperor penguins by the end of this century, at 75 years from now. It could be worse, but that really depends on us, how much carbon and methane we put into the atmosphere. Can we change the trajectory of global warming that we're on at the moment?
Changing that trajectory by sticking to a globally binding deal to end harmful fossil fuel use is the challenge for leaders meeting in Berlin this week, ahead of the latest United Nations talks in November. And yet, who pays for this kind of transition is always a contentious issue, especially given the poorest countries suffer disproportionately from the environmental impact generated by the wealthiest.
We need $5 trillion annually for a global ecological transition, with over $2 trillion of that specifically for developing countries. Half of the $2 trillion must come from sources within developing countries, and obviously the other half from international financial flows.
And as conservationists try to save Antarctica's emperor penguins from disappearing altogether, US forecasters are expecting above average temperatures this summer.
But as much to talk about, let's get to our panel. Mohammed Mahmoud leads the Middle East Institute's climate and water program. Also with us is Changhua Wu. She's the China director at the Office of Economist Jeremy Rifkin. And Salim Ali chairs the University of Delaware's Department of Geography and Spatial Sciences. He also serves as lead for critical minerals and inclusive energy transitions at the United Nations University's Institute for Water, Environment and Health. Thanks to all of you for being with us. Salim, let me start with you. If we look at global temperatures, the average global temperatures over the past 12 months, it rose by 1.58 degrees. That's 1.58 degrees Celsius. We could have more intense hurricanes. We could have heat waves. That rise that we're talking about, how will it affect weather patterns? What do you expect to happen?
Well, there was a report published in November around COP28, which focused on global tipping points. And five particular tipping points were identified, which could lead to an irreversible cycle on human timescales of weather changes. And the most significant is the Greenland ice sheet and its melting, which could then lead to changes in the Atlantic circulation patterns. And that in turn could lead to changes in terms of rainfall in the Amazon rainforest, and then that could impact our ability to sequester carbon. So this is very serious. This could lead to an irreversible impact in terms of changes of how humans are going to be living on this planet.
Right, and Salim, when you say irreversible, that sort of means that we've reached the point of no return, have we?
Yes, on human time scales, you know, of course, the planet has gone through changes over hundreds of millions of years, which are reversible. But we've been around as a species only for 100,000 years or so. So that's how we need to think about it. And often science gets confused because of the way in which time is expressed.
Mohammed Mahmoud, you recently wrote that the Middle East and North Africa are facing a water crisis that's been made worse by climate change. In fact, you say as climate change has increased temperatures in the region, we see a similar effect which is taking place in surrounding oceans, surrounding that region. So what are the consequences of rising ocean surface temperatures on weather patterns?
Well, the connection is very strong, and it leads to an unfortunate detrimental outcome, which is ocean bodies, certainly those closer to the equator, when you look at parts of the Pacific, Atlantic, Indian Ocean, warming of those waters tends to create conditions that are very conducive for storms and thunderstorms, and in extreme cases, cyclones and hurricanes, to be created and then eventually make landfall in surrounding areas. And we literally just saw this within the last week or so, the insane amount of rainfall and subsequent flooding that afflicted parts of the Arabian Peninsula, the UAE, Oman, Qatar, etc. And what makes this even more unusual and alarming in terms of the level of warming we've had, we don't expect these kinds of storms to occur in this part of the year. Usually it's at the end of the summer and the fall, when the waters have absorbed so much heat and temperature over the hottest part of the year. But to have this occur so early in the year, you can absolutely make the connection that it's connected to the amount of high level of warming and record-breaking heat we've been experiencing since essentially last summer.
Changhua Wu, South China experienced very heavy rainfall since the beginning of April. In fact, it was the second highest level since 1961. There were thousands of people, over 100,000 people, that had to be evacuated in Guangdong province. I mean, we're talking about an area of China that is heavily industrialized, very, very populous. We had torrential rains also fall over the Pearl River Delta, also a very populous industrial area. What's behind that weather cycle in China?
I think what the scientists are saying, as we are discussing here today now, basically, you know, this is subtropical super heat, high pressure warming the atmosphere definitely has been identified as a major cause, actually, for the torrential rainstorms in southern part of China. Of course, particularly getting into April. Now, literally now, at this very moment, southern part of China, the Pearl River Delta region is getting into another round of even more extreme rainstorms accompanied by very strong winds and very intensive lightnings, as well as actually hailstorms as well. And so it's a living example in terms of how global warming is impacting countries like China and other parts of the world, and we have to bear the costs and the losses there as well. So more urgent than ever, we need to transform. We need to decarbonize our energy system as quickly as possible at the scale that would meet up the challenge we are living in today. Yes, we are. We seem to be in a irreversible sort of situation. But as scientists are telling us, if we somehow stop emitting carbon dioxide greenhouse gases today, very soon we will be able to get to the point that sort of return back to a normal situation.
Right. And Changhua, well, why this particular region in China? I mean, are there other factors that are also contributing to conditions there?
Well, Guangdong province, the Pearl River Delta region, is a subtropical region. So every year it's pretty much prone to flooding, extreme weather events like rainstorms and others there. But usually that occurs in May, June, in the summer, throughout maybe getting into September. But April, you know, we are experiencing much earlier this sort of seasonal shift there. And if you look at, of course, aggravated by the climate change and, you know, all the facts shows it's definitely more intensive, sustained, extreme weather events there. It's challenging the region's resilience. Literally, you know, you have villages, farmlands, cities, you know, flooded everywhere, and disrupting not only people's daily lives, but also livelihoods. As you mentioned early on, this region, not only heavily populated, but also a heavy industrial region, is called the manufacturing hub for the rest of the world. So consequently, just imagining the global supply chain disruption there as well. Right. So we had to bear the costs today, and we had to take immediate actions.
Salim, if we look at the main sources of greenhouse gases, it mainly comes from cities. Of course, this is where there are high concentrations of people, where a lot of economic activity takes place. Currently, there are 3.3 to 3.6 billion people who live in cities, and they, of course, produce the most greenhouse gases. Cities also face flooding, they face water shortages, they face pollution as well. There is one study that's been done which says that this could cause up to 3.2 million deaths by 2050 in cities. What can you tell us about the impact that climate change is having, especially in very populous countries like India, like Pakistan, many of the countries of sub-Saharan Africa as well?
Yes, so, you know, cities are clearly part of the pollution generation problem, but they are also part of the solution because cities are a much more resource-efficient way of living if we plan them well. So you can distribute energy, water, and other resources much more efficiently in cities. And so what we should be trying to do is reinvent cities in ways that they can be more sustainable habitats and adaptive habitats. So even if we cross these tipping points, as we are very likely to do, it doesn't mean humanity will become extinct. It just means that we will have a very different future, which will be quite costly, which will need to be adaptive, and we will need to have very different habitation styles, whether that means in some cases living underground to have better cooling, or whether it means having a much more efficient way in which we provide our other services and utilities.
And we're joined now by Paul Bledsoe, who heads his own public policy firm and lectures at American University's Center for Environmental Policy. Paul, great to see you. We've been talking about the impact that this average rise in temperature that we've seen over the past 12 months is having on weather patterns around the world, the impact it's having on people and on regions. But there was one study that came out not so long ago, and it sort of went counter to prevailing thinking. This was a study that was done by Climate Analytics, which is a German-based think tank, and it says that the worst may actually be behind us. This think tank believes that there is a 70% chance emissions will start falling in 2024. That is if current clean technology efforts are maintained, if those growth trends continue. As I said, this is counter to what we've been told for the past few years. What's your view on that?
Well, unfortunately, I think that's rose-colored glasses, because temperature numbers keep increasing. We're already crossed the 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold. But the biggest problem is that we're tripping tipping points in natural systems like the Arctic sea ice, like the Amazon forest, like melting tundra, like the ocean temperatures. And once natural systems become net warming contributors instead of net warming inhibitors, we're in really bad trouble. And I'm afraid most models don't take that into account. And what that means, Anand, is we've got to focus on limiting near-term temperatures. And that's a very different strategy than long-term temperatures. The key to limiting near-term temperatures is reducing methane. I believe we need now a global separate treaty to mitigate methane, first from the fossil fuel sector and then eventually from other sectors. This is a global emergency. Cutting CO2 is absolutely crucial to long-term temperature reduction and climate stabilization. But unless we cut methane, HFCs, and the other super pollutants, we cannot reduce emissions.
Okay, I want to move on. Mohammed Mahmoud, you know, you were talking a moment ago about the heavy rainfall that we've seen in the Gulf area. We saw those pictures from Dubai, for instance. That was forecast. Why were those cities? I mean, we look at Dubai, or for instance, we look at other cities in the Gulf as well. These are highly developed cities. They are heavily populated, but they were not prepared for this.
No, they weren't. And I also don't want to be remiss and not say that, you know, just a couple of days prior, Pakistan and Afghanistan also experienced similar levels of flooding. The reality is, you know, people are always asking, well, why were they not prepared? What could they have done differently? Well, I would actually argue very little. The amount of precipitation rainfall that fell was quite unprecedented. I mean, it broke records in terms of the amount of rainfall in a 24-hour period in the case of the UAE that was held since 1949. And the other thing to consider is the geography and topography of that part of the world. It's very flat. There's not much opportunity for drainage and routing that other parts of the world have because of maybe elevated topography and changes in elevation. And so you could make a case that maybe there could be enhancements in terms of drainage and routing and absorption, but these are naturally dry areas. So when it rains that much, the soil is overwhelmed. It's not able to absorb as much of the water that comes down. And so that naturally runs off over land. So there's a case to be made that there could be some improvements, but I think just the amount, the sheer amount of rainfall that fell and the flooding that was generated, there was really not a lot that could have mitigated that.
Salim Ali, there are more than 150 countries right now that have set goals for peaking emissions and reaching carbon neutrality by 2050 or later. In fact, there are about 12 countries, smaller countries, that want to try and achieve those goals much earlier. What is your kind of status report on those efforts?
Well, you know, the problem is that we set these targets and then there's very little in terms of follow-up and making sure that they can be met. And because we are dealing with a soft law system with international environmental treaties, you don't have much accountability. You know, no one is going to impose a sanction on a country if they can't meet those targets. So I don't put too much emphasis on the targets. I focus much more on what has actually been done. Yeah. And this is also true of the fundraising. You know, keep in mind that you just showed the clip from the German environment minister saying you need $5 trillion. And you, foreign minister, I beg your pardon, that you need the $5 trillion to meet these targets. And if you think about the current pledges to the Green Climate Fund, even those which were set in COP15 in Copenhagen, so many years ago, we have still not met those. So I think we need also much greater accountability in terms of what these targets are and how they're being met. So I'm not very optimistic with the targets themselves. I think there are some countries which have made tremendous progress and they need to be congratulated. I think Japan has made tremendous progress in terms of how they have managed their resource efficiency. In many cases, China has as well, to some degree, certainly with reference to renewable energy.
Right.
But the decarbonization side still needs much more to be done.
Right, Changhua, we're on the question of renewable energy. I mean, China has installed more solar panels just in the past year than the United States has done in its entire history. And talking about targets, China hopes to peak its emissions by 2030 and reach carbon neutrality by 2060. In your view, are those goals still on target?
I definitely feel very confident, very positive. And so it's not by, it's a before. So there is a space, room in terms of China could aim higher and achieve those targets as soon as possible, particularly the peaking one. Particularly look at clean energy transition. If you look at a solar, wind, as well as electric vehicles, batteries there, China definitely has been gearing ahead and really leading global transformation and backed up by the very strong industrial value chains there. And unfortunately, the geopolitical situation is not really helping at this moment. And so we started to see more barriers blocking such kind of progress or rapid growth, particularly around the supply chain security issues there. But hopefully somehow hurdles removed so that China can cooperate more constructively with the rest of the world and really play its dual role to advance this transition as quickly as possible.
Okay, Paul, let's get to that conference that took place in Berlin. There were leaders from 40 countries. They just wrapped up those discussions. One of the issues that was raised was the impact that climate change is having on workers around the world. In fact, that was raised by the United Nations agency, the International Labour Organization. It's been talking about this for some time. Let's listen to part of what was discussed there.
more than 70% of our workers are exposed to excessive heat, at least excessive heat at one point in their working lives. That's 2.4 billion workers globally. The key issues we face are not where it's known to be very hot for the longest of period, where people are very acclimatized, but it's the new regions where heat was never such an issue and has become an issue, that we're facing some of the acute injuries that we're seeing today.
So, Paul, Manal Azhi there of the International Labour Organization, talking about the risks that workers around the world face. I mean, she pointed to that figure of 2.8 billion workers around the world. So how big is this risk, and what impact could it have globally?
I'm so glad you brought it up. The costs of climate change on our economies and just daily human existence are about to skyrocket. I don't think global leaders understand the negative side that climate change impacts are going to make it impossible in much of the world to work outside during the day. This is going to revolutionize outdoor economies around the world and add to costs, both healthcare costs and economic productivity problems. We really need to recognize that the costs of inaction are far greater than the cost of action. That's why we do need to set up special funding mechanisms in the next few years to get large amounts of money to decarbonize and reduce methane. If we do that, we will reduce these huge costs, humanitarian and economic, on average people, because they are coming very quickly.
Mohammed, there's also another phenomenon that we're seeing, and this is something known as coral bleaching. This is where coral reefs are degraded, and that's been caused by the rise in ocean temperatures, as well as pollution that is being caused by humans as well. I mean, there are some efforts being tried to mitigate the effects of this. Where does that stand right now?
Well, I think it goes hand in hand with the elevation in temperatures, right? And that's, obviously, we've been talking a lot about surface temperatures, but we've mentioned ocean temperatures. And the impacts are even far more far-reaching than that. Yes, coral reefs, are we're losing them in terms of bleaching, their quality, and their sustainability. Warmer waters, sort of proliferation of algae bloom, and that causes a cascading effect in terms of reducing the amount of dissolved oxygen. Why is that important? When we think about marine species, like certain types of, well, a lot of types of marine species that rely on dissolved oxygen to live and survive, like fish species, you start to now go into an area where there's going to be decline of different marine life. Obviously, from an environmental perspective, that is alarming, of losing certain species. But think of it in terms of a food chain perspective. Different parts of the world rely on fishing as a great source of sustenance, especially in parts of the world.
Chung Wa Wu, you know, I was talking about that report that was produced by the German-based think tank Climate Analytics, which presented a more optimistic picture of the kind of climate change challenges that we face right now. That think tank making the point that they think that the worst is behind us. But there's a lot of caveats attached to that. And some of them are the fact that to meet 2030 targets for cutting emissions, the world will need to stop deforestation, will have to stop new fossil fuel development, and also double energy efficiency. I mean, how likely is that?
Well, from an energy perspective, I think it's possible. If you look at renewable energy, if you look at energy efficiency, somehow global community has managed to continuously improving. If you look at energy efficiency, you see the decoupling effect in terms of, you know, economic growth versus actually the energy consumption, that there's a strong case made already. Then, of course, if you look at the renewable energy, clean energy coming on board, you know, China definitely represents the trend at this moment. It's really fascinating to see so, but of course, in the meantime, we need to phase down, potentially phase out fossil fuels as fast as possible, as we've committed even at, you know, this UAE, this COP28, this consensus, you know, new commitments made already to really accelerate tripling renewable energy by the end of this decade there. So yes, from an energy transition perspective, it's very promising. But if put that in the context of the sort of, you know, global warming situation, it's really tough, meaning we cannot just address energy transition issue. We have to take other issues into consideration in order to make sure, ensure the livelihoods actually of the human society.
And that's where we have to leave it. Thanks to all of you for being with us. And that is it for this edition of The Heat. I'm Anand Naidu in Washington, D.C.